There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Gross debt, when we look at a company's balance sheet, just the sheer amount of debt that is on their liability side of the equation has been growing. It's actually picked up following the pandemic. You would, in many cases, anticipate that debt might fall when markets are in that much turmoil, but the recovery to both the economy and the market has been very quick.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So maybe corporate debt levels are increasing despite higher interest rates, so the cost of borrowing has gone up. Couldn't that be the chain holding back a company? Sure, I mean, if they use that money to grow, that's better than not borrowing at all. But if the cost of borrowing was lower, then surely they have more funds to do more with. So at times like this, when interest rates are so high, doesn't it just reinforce slow growth? And is there a way to try and encourage more investment and more growth so we produce more and fix the supply issue, which is keeping inflation high? In other words, does corporate debt kill opportunity? That's this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. So if you've got a good idea for a business, what's stopping you making money from it? Well, probably the answer is that the money that you need to actually get it going. For that, you need a loan or an investor, either a bank that you have to pay back or an investor who wants a share in a company, whether it's debt financing or equity financing. That's the question, isn't it? Take your pick. You'd assume if you can find someone who wants to play ball, then a loan is the best because you're not giving away any of your company. But what's in favour really depends on how the economy is doing. So there was a Deloitte survey in October last year that found that CFOs in bigger companies right now prefer equity financing to debt financing, either from debt financing either being bank loans or issuing bonds. Why? Well, obviously, with inflation high and bond yields rising, debt is more expensive now. So that is part of the problem, isn't it, Steve? When the economy struggles, borrowing money becomes more expensive. So you have the risk of less demand and higher borrowing costs. Why would you want to set up or expand a business in an environment like that? And that is that's a real problem, because how do you get out of a downturn economy if no one wants to invest?
Yeah, and this is one of the main problems with bank lending, is that it's an expensive form of finance, which the advantage of it is that it's a fixed percentage, floating percentage sometimes, of the amount of money you've raised. You don't give any ownership of the firm away. So that's one reason that existing companies prefer to have debt over equity, because if they're going to raise money by equity, then they've got to give away part of the ownership of the firm. So in general, there's a bias in favor of debt finance over equity finance for existing companies. But the danger is, of course, that there are various times in history, and the most recent period of rate rises by the Federal Reserve is one of them, that there's an unexpected increase in the cost of that money, and suddenly what was originally a cheap form of finance becomes a very expensive one. And then you'll start looking at the equity option,
which is what's happening now with bigger companies. Whichever way you look at it, and let's look at it from a startup business, a slice of business that you create, unless you've saved up for years and don't need any extra money, a slice of your business, either whether it's through a loan or whether it's through equity, is basically you're going to be paying the finance sector. And the higher the risk of your business, the more the finance sector gets. Which, I mean, that's just the way it is. But it's not an ideal situation, is it?
Not by a long shot. I mean, I'm one of the world's experts on how money is created and what money is created for. And if you look back through history, one of the most eloquent writers on what banks should do when they create money is Joseph Schumpeter. And if people haven't read it, then I highly recommend taking a look at his book, The Theory of Economic Development. Do not bother with his most popular book called Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. That was his pension plan. It's a load of boring twaddle that I read when I was a student and couldn't work out why anybody thought you should take Schumpeter seriously. Theory of Economic Development is a much, much richer text. And what he talks about there is the role of banks in creating money for entrepreneurs. So what he says the function of banks is to give money to entrepreneurs, who he effectively defines as people with a good idea and no money. And then it says, well, the banking sector creates money for them, and that is an actual creation of money. It's not a transfer of existing money from one person to another, which is the mainstream economic myth of what banks actually do. Schumpeter fully understood that banks create money when they lend. But he said what they do is, by creating money and giving it to an entrepreneur, they enable the entrepreneur to turn that good idea into actual products. The trouble is, first of all, banks, generally speaking, aren't going to fund entrepreneurs, startups, because if you're giving somebody debt financing, then you only get, you know, let's say if you even put an interest rate like 10% on the debt, you're getting 10% of the money you've lent them to them. What happens if they fail? Now, if they fail, you lose your you lose your money as a bank. But if they succeed dramatically, you're still just getting 10% of what you offered them, when they could go from being, you know, worth what Microsoft was in a garage with Bill Gates and a few of his dorky looking friends, to when it becomes the world's largest corporation. And the bank itself doesn't benefit from that increase in the valuation of the company, whereas somebody taking an equity position does. So we have quite a distorted system for finance, which really only suits companies that already exist and need working capital. It doesn't suit startups at all.
So yeah, because, and by the way, Bill Gates, even though he's got, you know, billions now, still managing to look dorky. So that's amazing. He's managed to pull that off throughout his entire life, irrespective of.
Well, he didn't have the same plastic surgeons that Elon Musk has used, obviously.
He's got a plastic surgeon. Has Elon Musk gone down the plastic surgery? Has he?
He was going bald in his 20s. I mean, if you find photographs of him when he was back in the PayPal days, it was a receding hairline that looked like he was making way for a new runway at Heathrow. And now he's got a full head of hair.
Oh, well, that's a hair transplant.
He's bulked up.
Yeah. So
a hair transplant, definitely. But there's also been, I think there's been a jaw transplant and a nose transplant as well.
Right.
Bill hasn't done any of that, and he still looks like he's the sort of person who should be doing your accounting for you, not the person.
Well, yeah, it's wondering whether he's having plastic surgery to keep that door. Dorkiness. So I'm not looking as dorky. Please give me some more dorky features. Maybe that's it.
You know, I'm going to tell the tale out of school here, because I've worked in the software industry for quite some time. And one of my best mates at the time I was in the industry, I've lost touch with him now, was looking forward to meeting Bill Gates at a party. And because there's a social thing with his software company. And then he meets Gates, and he's chatting up, and Gates is in the kitchen with this mate of mine, and Gates is chatting up a young woman, forgotten, didn't know any who she was these days. And then Gates finishes the chat and turns to my mate and says, "God, I love flirting," and walks out of the room. That was the intellectual contribution he got from meeting Bill Gates.
Right, fantastic. So let's get back to the discussion. Just want to talk about Bill Gates flirting. I mean, two words have never been put a sentence together.
The whole thought of him flirting is looking like a dork is it isn't Hollywood.
It gives us all hope, though. Perhaps should we ever be engaged in that, which I don't think, I hopefully won't be for the rest of my life. But look, nothing wrong with flirting, I guess. Let's get back to this. So, the issue is, isn't it, that you've basically, banks or anyone lending wants an asset sitting behind it. There's got to be something.
Yep, absolutely.
And if you haven't got one, you haven't got one. So how do we get over that problem?
Well, this is what actually has happened. And this, I mean, I remember meeting Michael Pascoe, who was a fairly popular finance journalist back in Australia. And he was complaining about falling house prices, but saying, well, the way that people make their money, that become entrepreneurs these days, is they make money on house speculation and then use the house speculation to set up a business. So to use another Australian example, and this is a much far less dorkier person and actually a very decent human being, John Hewson, whom I met and knew through quite a few interviews in Sydney, a damn decent man, and I'm extremely sorry that he didn't become prime minister rather than that jerk John Howard. But Hewson made his money initially.
All over a birthday cake.
Over a birthday cake, I know. Hewson made his money in restaurants, but he made the money to establish the restaurant by selling a house for a profit on a rising market. So fundamentally what has happened now is that if you're going to want to start a business, the best way is to borrow money from a bank to buy a house, watch the house increase in value because, hey presto, the banks are lending too much money for housing finance, sell for the capital gain, and then invest your capital gain in a business. It's a totally convoluted way to go about what should be a much more fluid process of a funding organization, whether that's a bank or a venture capitalist, or whatever they are from the finance sector, assessing what you're talking about, saying, hey, this is revolutionary, or this is a damn good restaurant, and then providing finance for you and benefiting out of the act of you turning that concept into something which is successful and grows the equity value over time. So in that sense, the only form of banking that looks a bit like that, and it's not enough like that, is the Islamic system of finance, where because they effectively ban interest, what they're banning is not the funder getting a gain. That's what people think comes out of the banning of interest. They're saying the funder has to take a risk on the capital value of the business that's being established. So I think it's called halal finance. I'm not sure. I'm sure some friends will correct me. But halal finance basically says a bank lends an equity position. It doesn't lend a debt position. And therefore, the upside for a bank lending that way is that if you are the next Microsoft and they lend you $1 million to establish the business for a 25% share in the equity, then that 25% share of $1 million becomes 25% of $10 trillion, and you've done extremely well, but you also lose money on the other ones that don't succeed.
Right, but that's not the ideal situation, though, is it, for a lot of people, giving away so much equity in a business? If it's a clear winner, you don't want to do that. I mean, because all that's doing is saying, well, okay, they don't allow debt finance, they allow equity finance. That's what's permissible under Islamic law.
Well, I'm literally in that situation right now. I mean, this is going to... Hopefully, in about 3 to 6 months' time, I'll be releasing a software package called Ravel, which I've developed with my great friend and brilliant programmer, Russell Standish, built on top of the Minsky software. And we have done that ourselves in our spare time, financing it ourselves out of, superannuation savings and things of that nature, and putting in our time to get it developed. It's taken over a decade. Now, what would have been the ideal situation would be to be able to approach a fan financier saying, look at what this idea can do. Give us the money to enable us to get it done in 2 or 3 years, and then we're happy to give you a 25% share, for example. But that what happens with venture capital, which is the other side of debt finance, is that they basically take an arm and a leg out of you. 25% would be a bargain. And quite frequently, I've heard so many horror stories of what happened to entrepreneurial companies when they went the venture capitalist route, that we've avoided that as well. So you've got the worst of both worlds. You've got an equity share, which ends up cauterizing you and, amputating your gain, and often you end up with nothing or even less, or debt finance, which won't even approach you in the first place, because quite sensibly, a bank says, if we take a punt on you and the area you're talking about succeeds, but you individually don't, we lose all our money. So the entrepreneurship falls through the cracks.
Well, and isn't that happening? Because there will be a world of good ideas out there, which all could potentially add to the growth of the economy. And, of course, here's the rub, speed up our transition, our climate transition, at least our mitigating action against climate change. So all of these things that are needed and need investment, the speed at which they happen, even though the good ideas might exist, the speed at which they happen is largely determined by the stance being taken by the finance sector. There's no way around that, is there?
No, there isn't, unless we actually redesign finance. One thing I proposed, which will never happen, of course, because it's a good idea, is to enable banks to offer either equity or loan positions when they take on a company. Now, the danger, then, one reason that's not allowed is, of course, what happened in the 1920s when banks were not differentiated into commercial banks and retail banks, but they were one group together, and banks were able to buy shares on the stock market. Now, when you look at what happened in the 1920s, it's quite horrific. This is data that I'm publishing in my next book, which is called Rebuilding Economics from the Top Down, and that's what I've written while I've been here in Budapest with the Budapest Center for Long-Term Sustainability. And I looked at the level of margin debt over the last 100 years. And it takes a lot to shock me in economic data, but I almost fell off my chair when I first plotted this margin debt, which of course is brokers lending you money so that you can gamble on the increased value of shares, rose from 0.5% of GDP in 1920 to 8.5% in 1929. And is it any wonder the stock market exploded? So what you had was
like a 16-fold increase.
16-fold increase over 10 years. That's what caused the bubble in the stock market. That's what made everybody look wealthy in the 1920s, and it caused the Great Depression.
So this is banks investing in the customers' money or their reserves or both?
What margin loans is you go to a bank with say for 10,000. Let's go back to the 1920s, and you're a fairly wealthy person with $10,000 spare. You go to a broker, and the broker says, "Oh, don't just put your whole money in there. Take out a margin loan, and you, with that 10,000 as a deposit, you can bet $100,000. We'll lend you $90,000 at a very, very generous rate of interest. And then if the stock market goes up by 10%, you double your money." And they say, "Oh, what happens if it goes down 10%? Oh, that'll never happen." Well, it did in one day.
And that money that they're giving, that leverage is all money that's been created by the bank, of course.
Again, and that's what causes the bubble. So what we end up with the banking sector, which finds it easier to finance asset speculation than it does entrepreneurship. So back in the 1920s, it was margin loans, and also banks taking their own positions in the stock market as well, which was, you had a double whammy there, causing inflated asset prices, and that all came crashing down in October 1929. What we have now is they've done the same thing with mortgage debt. So it's very, very difficult for a bank to decide whether a particular entrepreneur's idea is going to work, but it's very easy to see that there's a house on a block of land over there in an area where house prices are rising, and you finance a person buying it at a higher price than the original buyer now seller paid for it, and you get another asset price bubble. So we have a finance sector that on the one hand promotes asset bubbles and on the other hand doesn't provide finance for entrepreneurs.
No, but that is a world away from a bank saying, well, okay, let's give you a loan for you to invest in a business, rather than saying, well, okay, let's give you a loan so that you can buy listed assets. This is, you know, for somebody else's business. I mean, they're two worlds apart. So what's stopping banks saying, well, we are going, apart from the fact that they don't want to take the risk, perhaps because they don't need to, what's stopping banks saying, well, we're going to invest more in businesses, more in startups, helping these entrepreneurs? What's stopping them doing that?
Well, the main thing is because they have to maintain positive equity. And this is, again, when you've got to look at the structure of finance and say, what are the strengths and weaknesses of the system as it stands, and how can we accentuate the strengths? And with an absolutely vital condition for a bank is that its financial assets, short-term financial assets, must exceed its short-term financial liabilities. Now, its main financial liabilities are deposits. Okay? Its main financial assets are loans and also reserves. And if you have a bank lending to actual entrepreneurs, then it's quite possible that a rough rule of thumb, out of five entrepreneurs, four are going to fail. So if you lend $1 million to each, and with one of them making a fortune and therefore paying their 10% of $1 million each year, 100,000 revenue coming in, yada, 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 but the other four go bankrupt, that part of your equity is wiped out. So when people can't repay their loans, so when entrepreneurs fail and they can't repay the money they've borrowed, then the bank has to take that hit on its equity. And if it does that, it goes bankrupt. And then that's the end of the bank. And that, of course, causes crises, not just for the bank, but also for the finance, for the monetary system, the expenditure system you and I absolutely rely upon.
Right, which raises the question, is there more of a role for the government, or does the government need to be more involved in the running of banks? We'll look at both of those questions when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast, back in a second.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So we're looking at how businesses are financed and how, you know, when you do finance a business, it's through the finance sector. They end up, you either end up owing them a lot of money or they end up owning a lot of your company. And the big problem is, of course, a lot of great ideas are stopped, are stymied by the fact that there just isn't that funding available coming from banks. Now, Steve, we talked about just before the break, the banks don't want to take risks because they don't want to run into a situation where they've got negative equity, where they go bankrupt, in other words. But what happens in China? Because there, I don't know if you know too much about the way they're funding a lot of loans there, but a lot of the operization, is that the word? That's a difficult word to get, isn't it?
Anyway. Try it again. What's the tongue twister again?
I can't even say it. Anyway, a lot of the operation, day-to-day operation of giving loans is managed through local banks, isn't it? Because they, you know, like almost like community banks, because they're close to the businesses. But they take risks, and then the government somehow steps in. Is that because the government is trying to stop those banks going bankrupt to try and alleviate that problem that we talked about?
Large part of it is. Now, this is one of Richard Werner's specializations, the role of local banks in enabling entrepreneurial investment to take place. So if you have a bank, which, you know, where the bank manager lives in the local community, knows the potential applicants for loans for new ventures, then they will be aware of who is and who is not a credit risk, who looks like they've got a great idea, who could be a good manager, who's got a good track record, if it's a serial entrepreneur, that sort of thing. So they're more likely to fund small ventures, which can turn into big ones over time. So my favorite example there was, I think I've mentioned this before on the podcast, but I was invited to a conference in Bonn in Germany, and then the person who invited me said, "Oh, don't stay at the hotel. Stay with me and my wife in our house." And I said, "Okay, I agreed to that." Well, 130 kilometers later, we got to their house in a tiny little village, 5,000 people in Germany. And it happened to be July 4th, which was the night of an annual concert held around the local extinct volcano caldera. Superb experience with an orchestra. Sopranos, altos, magnificent experience. Anyway, the whole town was there, the whole 5,000 people, to enjoy this once-a-year concert. And there's an old couple sitting on a park bench. And my host walked past and chatted to them, introduced me and so on, and walked away. And he said, "Oh, they're the owners of the biggest company in the village." And I said, "Oh, what do they produce?" My expectation being he's going to say, you know, krautwurst, liverwurst, blah, blah, blah. He said, "Satellites." Now, the old couple, the two top-class engineers, the local bank manager knew they were brilliant and financed them building a factory in that town that makes satellites, a village of 5,000 people. So that's an example of the sort of thing which can happen when the bank is run by somebody who knows the local community. Instead, what happens these days, it all goes off to some bloody head office and they credit score you. If you don't have the assets, you don't get the loan.
Yeah, exactly. But what happens in the situation, if you did go down that road, what happened if that satellite business business failed and the bank was putting itself at risk. Is there a way that a system could be developed that starts to... I mean, I hate the idea of taking risk out of banks because we know how they misbehave when risk is taken off the table. But is there a way that, you know, that risk could be alleviated in some way to try and encourage more giving of these loans?
Well, that's where the government role comes in again, because essentially, you know, banks don't exist unless they're chartered by a government. You become a bank. You get a bank license, and to get a bank license, you've got to show you've got a positive equity. So you start up by raising capital for that purpose. You then have a set of money to put forward. You get all the due diligence done on you and so on. But that gives you a capacity to create money. And that comes from the state giving you that license. Now, one thing which could be done is be the state again to say, okay, we're going to give you this license. We usual sort of loans are going to exist, but it will give you a right to also, give entrepreneurial loans, which can be in like an equity position rather than a debt position, a debt lien against the people you lend to. And we're going to cover the possibility that those are going to fail. Now, a large part of what China does, and again, this is by reading some recent work by Richard Werner on this front, he argues that what the China did was realize that situation in both Germany and Japan through all the small banks. And what it's doing is encouraging the banks to lend to local engineers that they expect to come up with brilliant ideas. And clearly, China's had a lot of those in the last 30 years. And if they fail, then the government covers them through the government's capacity to create money. Because, and this is one reason why modern monetary theory is so important, we know the government can create money simply by spending more than it gets back in taxation. It can equally create money to cover losses by the commercial banks when they make entrepreneurial loans that fail. You have to have some limits and controls there, and you have to make sure there's not corruption going on as well between a government official and a local bank, which obviously does occur. But that's what has to happen.
Right. But you can only create money so long as you are growing the economy, of course. Otherwise, you are going to start to see inflation. But you are creating money in this instance because you are hopefully growing the economy. You might have a few bad eggs, a few misfires, but you would generally be making that money available to fund the development of new businesses, which are going to be productive.
Yeah, and like this again is something Schumpeter argues brilliantly in the theory of economic development, that when you he does what economists should have done, and obviously they haven't, which is to make a set of assumptions that makes it harder for him to make his case. So he argued that for the role of the importance of entrepreneurship and innovation and enabling capitalism to transform itself over time. And he assumed initially that the economy was fully employed. Therefore, there weren't free resources you could hire by raising money to hire workers and buy machinery and so on. You have to bid stuff away from existing firms. That made it harder to make his overall case. He also assumed that entrepreneurs didn't have money, whereas, of course, some entrepreneurs, like, let's say, Elon Musk, had money and therefore could start some of their investment on their own. They didn't need to borrow from a bank. So made all these things more difficult for himself in terms of reasoning how the whole thing happened. What he then explained was how that would cause cycles in economic activity. So if you have one entrepreneur in a particular area, let's say rockets, getting finance, then that means that the success of that particular funding operation leads to more people coming forward with ideas about rockets. You get more companies being made who produce rockets. That gives you a boom in money production in the first instance. They go out and eat sushi every afternoon. So you've now got the sushi restaurants and everybody else in the local community benefiting as well. Yeah, you got to burn. And then, of course, when the products come on sale, what they do is start undercutting other businesses. So once you have satellites being able to take the place, for example, of laying optical fiber, then the optical fiber business suddenly starts losing money. So when the technology comes on stream, it actually causes a downturn in economic activity because it's undercutting the existing businesses that this entrepreneurial innovation is targeted at.
Right. So, are you saying that's a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I say it's a natural part of the dynamics of a private credit system.
Yeah,
and if you only had private credit, you have those booms and busts. And what the government could do is enable the downturn, the bust, to be less severe than it was otherwise. What Schumpeter left out of his thinking was the accumulation of debt over time, whereas Hyman Minsky, his PhD student, was the one who focused on that and said, if you have these booms and busts, they can lead to an accumulation of private debt that ultimately causes a Great Depression, which is what happened. So we have to think intelligently about finance, and that's the last thing I'd accuse mainstream economics of doing.
So part of the problem is that, you know, we are limited by the vagaries of central banks and interest rates. And why does it have to be that way when we're looking at investments for new enterprises? Okay, central banks put interest rates up because they feel like the economy is running too hot. They're trying to quell consumption by and large. But they don't want to stop growth, because if we've got growth, then we can cope with more consumption. We want the economy to grow, you know, ignoring the effects of climate change. So should we be saying, well, okay, interest rates should be different depending on the purpose of the loan? If you are establishing a new business, we'll always charge 2% or whatever, just set a standard rate away from the way the economy is behaving at that time.
Yeah, and that's quite feasible, because again, one of the reasons that people think that private interest rates have to be higher than the reserve interest rate is they think that banks are borrowing at this amount and they've got to lend at a higher level. They've got to have a margin above their cost of money for them. But in fact, the reserve interest rates are settlement account rates. They're not money the banks don't lend. This is the whole myth that banks lend out reserves. They do not do that. So it'd be quite possible to have a different rate on reserves than you have on commercial loans and still be profitable as a bank. I think in many ways banks use the reserve rates as a cover for putting up the rates they charge the rest of us in the economy. So rates tend to follow the level of economic growth and the rate of and the rate set by the central bank, when they don't have to do that. Mm. It's a bit of a con job.
Yeah, well, strangely, they do seem to make bigger profits, don't they, when interest rates are higher. Why would that be?
I wonder.
So, all right. So the UK government does own the Infrastructure Bank. They set that up in 2021. They say providing $22 billion or pounds, I should say, of infrastructure financing and partnering with the private sector and local government to finance a green industrial revolution and drive growth across the country. It is run by people from the banking sector, though. So the CEO is John Flint, who is the CEO of HSBC. It's a government-run investment bank. I guess nothing wrong with that, but I'm not quite sure whether they are doing anything different. So they say they are not crowding out private investment because they're going to areas where private investors won't go, which is anywhere without a house. And yet they made 110 million profit in the year 21 to 22 with a 30% return on equity. So, I mean, it is a profit-making enterprise. I mean, that's not really going to fix things, is it?
It's good that they're doing something like that. It's better than completely ignoring the need to give entrepreneurs finance. But yeah, it's if you focus on making a profit out of that thing. I mean, sometimes when you have the government can create money effectively costlessly because that's what a fiat currency is, then you want that creation of money to be able to improve the functioning of capitalism, not cause speculative bubbles, or not end up taking more money out than they put in when they start making a rate of return as high as that. So I'm glad to see them doing it. But what we really need to say is, well, what's the special thing about capitalism compared to any other social system? And without doubt, it's the impetus it gives to innovation. And that is what we should have the finance sector being the servant of, rather than the master extracting the revenue, rather than being the as we call them, the vampire squids of the world, rather than the transfusion experts, which is what they should be.
Well, I'm just wondering whether the government actually has a vehicle already that they could be doing more with. So the tax office, I mean, companies are registered with them. They've all got a transaction account. Every business has got a transaction account with the tax office, and if they don't, they should. I know the tax office currently charges high interest rates if you're late paying your tax, because they say they don't want to be seen as a bank. But I mean, why not? A lot of the borrowing for businesses actually, I mean, we're talking about, businesses borrowing to establish growth. But actually, a lot of the borrowing, particularly over the last few years, has been companies trying to manage their cash flow. Mm. So, a chunk of that is going to be meeting tax obligations. Currently, the tax office says they will charge you interest of whatever the central bank base rate is, plus 2.5% for late payment, or 3.5%, whichever is lower. So, but you know, the minimum they're going to charge you is 3.5%. So it's quite a penalty for being late in paying your tax. But people are borrowing money. So businesses are borrowing money from banks to cover their cash flow to pay their tax. I mean, that is a crazy situation.
Like, Australia was worse. I've forgotten the actual name of the taxation, but I got hit by this a couple of times when I was doing software consulting, that they had a tax which was an advance tax. You had to pay the tax before you earned the income, or it was like
a nominal tax. Yeah. You pay based on, and so if you, and the problem with that is if you have a really good year followed by a bad year, that bad year, you might find that you're paying tax for that year based on how well you did the year before, even though you're doing really badly. And there's not a lot. So, but if the tax office said, well, okay, tell you what, you know, so long as you pay your tax over a period of 5 years or whatever, you're going to go into debt. You're going to have boom years. Let's just give you a very low interest rate. And by the way, if you want to borrow some money, so long as it falls within, you know, whatever we believe is, you know, a reasonable risk, given the turnover that we've seen, because nobody knows more about your business than the tax office, then, you know, why not give you loans? Why not allow you to go into the red? Why not charge you very low interest based on that? I mean, the system is there. Obviously, you'd have to sack everybody in the tax office and get someone with a completely different psyche. But I mean, it seems like an opportunity, doesn't it?
Well, that's again what the Chinese seem to have done. And a large part of saying that finance is not there for the sake of its own benefit. Finance is there to enable us to turn a peasant-based, third-world, backward society, and I saw it was like in 1981, 82, turn that into an industrial powerhouse. And hey, presto, look what they've done. I mean, that's one of the most remarkable, probably the most remarkable in history, in fact, transformation of a backward economy into a hyper-advanced one in a matter of 40 years. And they're, even though, I mean, I've got my severe worries about climate change, as you know, they're doing probably more than any other country as well to lay down alternative energy sources and to reduce energy consumption where possible in areas like, and when you put down high-speed rail, you don't have people driving cars everywhere to get around. It's much faster to hop on a high-speed train to go from Shanghai to Beijing than it is to drive the bloody way there, which would be the only way to get between Boston and New York that's worth considering, is driving or flying, because the transit is so bloody slow. So there's enormous ways in which that industrial transformation for a country of a billion people has been remarkably successful, and a large part of it comes down to how they've organized the finance and the state providing that buffer to enable banks to fund entrepreneurs and innovation, right, rather than the speculation which we get in the West.
So there's two issues here, isn't there? One is the risk element that's stopping banks from giving loans, or anybody giving loans to what is seen as a high-risk investment. And secondly, if it is a high-risk investment, it's the interest rate that's going to be charged on that, which actually in itself could destroy the business model, which stops startups happening in the first place. So the way around that is, yes, there needs to be more state involvement to de-risk, and as part of that de-risking, bringing that interest rate down.
Yeah, and also enabling, I mean, I'm quite in favor of banks taking an equity position. The one thing I've seen against that, which I have to mention, this actually came from an earlier podcast of ours, is somebody who does have a few bank representatives on their board saying, look, they're a pain in the butt. They have no bloody idea about the business. They get in the way. So you don't want that equity position, meaning a control position for a financial sector. And I'll quote another person who felt the same way about that, a little bloke by the name of Karl Marx, who wrote this wonderful set of lines. He said, talk about centralization. The big financiers and the parasites hanging off them periodically get the capacity to take over real production, and this gang knows nothing about it and should have nothing to do with it. He called them the roving cavaliers of credit, which is the title of one of my most successful blog posts. So yeah, you don't want the banks running the show, but you do want them taking an equity position rather than a debt position, because they're more likely to take out large loans, they're more likely to get entrepreneurial finance occurring, and you have to find a way of preventing that causing them going bankrupt by the inevitable failure of about 4 out of 5 entrepreneurs.
Which means there has to be a reliance on the government in some way.
Yeah.
And regionalized. standardizing it so that they are closer. That was the other thing we've covered today. But just on this thing about the tax office, I mean, do you think that's a good idea? The reason I'm mentioning it is because some facts. The overall value of UK SME bank loans was $65.1 billion in 2022. That was up almost 13% from the year before. The median average value of SME loans was £14,000 in 2022, which was a 40% rise in 2021. And more than two-thirds of SMEs claim their reason for requiring external finance was cash flow related. So for businesses to collapse because of cash flow, and lots of businesses do in January because they might have had a lean Christmas, and then the tax office calls for tax at the end of January. Perfect timing. That's when business, and miraculously, that's when businesses fail, January and February. And the tax office has a part to play with that. So actually turning around the tax office to actually be a company that, a division of the government that actually helps businesses stay alive rather than killing them, that would be quite a good turn of events as well.
And this would also come out of understanding modern monetary theory, which is actually just a description of the accounting of money, fiat money creation. That's what it fundamentally is. Governments don't finance themselves by taxation, but the mentality we have that taxation is needed to finance the activities of government is what leads to that sort of predatory taxation policies by governments around the world. And what they realized, they were simply taking money out of circulation, because if the government simply spent, 30% of GDP and didn't tax 28% of it back again, or 25%, you'd have an incredible runaway level of money supply, and of course that would generate inflation ultimately. It's just a way of taking that money out of circulation. You don't want to take it out of circulation if people coming up with new ideas. Better to take it out of those with old ideas, and the timing has to be thought of. So you have to be aware of all these issues of how private corporations are formed and the fragility of an entrepreneurial business. The tax office right now is doing precisely the wrong thing, because even though they're full of accountants, just like most of the bloody world, they don't understand how money is created.
No. And hence, that's why they say, well, we don't want to behave like a bank. And that's why they charge base rate plus 2.5% for late payments. I know I sound bitter. Yeah. It's almost as though I've had to pay
you
that,
You are, because it just happened. I was just wondering. There may have been a coincidence here. I did think that. Yeah.
Not this year, but it has in the past. And certainly, I have been caught out by that, good year followed by bad year having to pay the same tax in advance. It absolutely cuts our family spending. Therefore, it's not good for the economy. And it's all just to do with cash flow, nothing to do with, the overall long-term performance of the business. So,
There's just the slump that occurs in January, and then it's when you've got to pay your tax. It's a double whammy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, never a good time. And here we are. Look, my goodness, it's the end of January. Good to talk, Steve. We'll catch you again next time.
Okay, mate. Bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.